Everyone. Hello, Pacific Palisades. Welcome to the August 2021 podcast edition of the Pali Podcast. Steve and I are so excited to be back here because we missed July. Imagine that. We took a vacation. Steve and I missed the July podcast, but we're thrilled to be back. Today we have Alan Eisenstock with us. He is decidedly a writer. He'll tell us how and in what ways and how it started in fifth grade and ended here after a full career doing screenwriting and now prose. So we're thrilled to have you. Welcome to the podcast. Steve, how's it going for you on this lovely overcast
August
day?
Things are great. Just had family in and starting to get ready for the fall, and glad to be here with you and with Alan and kick off our post-summer sessions here.
Very exciting. Alan, what did you do this summer? It was a weird summer. We thought maybe we were free to go about our business, but then we were told we weren't, and we had to put our masks back on and go back indoors. How was your summer?
Well, here's the thing. My summer and winter and fall and spring are always exactly the same. I don't change. COVID was horrible, and the pandemic, of course, was terrible. And then we can talk about this later, but one thing I started about a year and a half ago is I started doing a weekly playlist about COVID and, the theme being COVID. So I did do that. But because I never leave my house and all I do is sit in front of the computer all day and drink coffee and write, it wasn't that much different. I'll say this. 95% of my life was exactly the same, but there's this 5% where I would go and get coffee with friends, or I'd go to a restaurant, or just sort of go places. That part, of course, I missed. So, you know, missing that 5% was really, really tough, I think. Yeah. But the answer, the long answer to your very simple question is, I didn't do really anything except work.
Yeah. So what do you mean by playlist? A musical playlist you came up with to correlate
with
the pandemic?
Yeah, this is my passion now. I don't care about anything else anymore. All I care about are these playlists. No, what happened was when the pandemic hit, in March of 2020, and Gavin Newsom gave the order that we should all shelter in place, somebody sent me a playlist on Spotify, like 3 or 4 or 5 songs, and I said, well, that's interesting. So I've always been into music. Here we are in this incredibly iconic recording studio. And I thought, well, I could do a playlist based on COVID. So I put together a few songs, and I sent it to my kids and my family and some friends. And I started doing it every week. And I always with a theme, something to do with COVID. And then finally, my daughter, who's in New York, said, you know, these are too short. We're all using it to walk and exercise. I said, wait a second, who's we? And she said, well, my boss and all the people I work with.
Oh, my God, that's fantastic.
And then my wife said, and I don't know some of these songs. I need some, I need some context. I said, oh, okay, liner notes. So I expanded the playlists to about an hour. And so I send them out every week, and then Circling the News, Sue Pascoe picked it up, and so now I put it out every single Friday at noon.
That is amazing. So you go into your personal archive of music and you find a theme that...
Yeah, well, it's always about COVID, so there's something...
So what? Name me one song that like is about COVID or happens to...
Well, I did one of the more recent ones. So the most current one is the CDC director, Rochelle Walensky, said, you know, we're not out of the woods yet. So I said, okay, this week's theme is not out of the woods yet. So all the songs are about woods, flowers, roses, trees. So I have Lemon Tree, Where Have All the Flowers Gone?
That is
Norwegian
fantastic.
Wood.
And how do you come up with all these titles? I mean, how do you...
I don't know. Bill Brun said, you're going to run out of ideas, you know. And I took that as a challenge. And I said, I'm not going to run out of ideas. COVID, sadly, doesn't seem to be going away so quickly. And so there's all sorts of, you know, I did, one was, something was wear a mask. That was one theme. So I started with the theme from Zorro.
Oh.
And then I did, you know...
Cool.
Songs about faces the first time ever I saw your face. And so I've always been a music lover and a music geek. And so sometimes, you know, a theme will occur to me and then I'll just 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 songs will just snap into my head. And then after that, I'll say, okay, well, there's a theme here and I'll start looking up.
And for all of our millions of listeners, including Miriam and I. How do we access your list?
Well, there are two ways. I can get your emails and send it to you out every Friday, which I'm happy to do. And then, as I said, if you know about circling the news, Sue Pascoe's, I guess, news e-newsletter, it appears every Sunday. Thank you, Sue.
So I want to share with you, interestingly, that in the beginning when it was all about we're all in this together, so in my head would swim around the theme of, what was it, the High School Musical? We're all in this together.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So there you go.
Yeah.
That's amazing. So we're...
Now, let me tell you something. I can't make a living doing the playlist, but it's a riot. I love doing it, and it's really keeping me sane. And I want to say one more thing about it, is that what's happened is I've connected with so many people from my past. I just sort of sent out, and people that I haven't heard from for years have been emailing me, and we've had sort of a renewal of a relationship. So it's been really
amazing.
I also do a poll question every week, which I'll
that
give
goes
you,
along with the playlist.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So it's part of the playlist, and you get to, I'll say, which do you prefer, this song or this song, and then people vote. It's just to get people involved, and so it's obviously it's become sort of an addiction.
How many? Do you have any idea how many people are following your playlist?
I would say around 2,000.
Wow.
Alan, that's amazing. I love these little stories where, you know, something starts with just a spark in someone's head, and it's just for fun, and it becomes something important. I mean, there are 2,000 people who find your playlist to assist them in getting through this pandemic. I think that's amazing.
Well,
it's funny
you.
That you say that you can't make a living out of it, because I got the feeling when I was reading about your life story, your life trajectory, that when you thought about walking away from screenwriting and writing prose, you weren't really sure it would work out for a living. And then, like, you know, 20 books later.
Yeah, that's 100% true. And I've never really thought about putting the financial part of creative life first. It just never occurred to me. And I guess I'm not built that way, but that's right. I get people now, or even shortly after I said, I can't do this anymore. I think I'm going to have a heart attack and die in the writer's room of some sitcom. But I just knew that I had to do it really to save my life, I think. And so my wife was incredibly supportive. You know, we had the lifestyle of the TV showrunner. You know, we had a huge house in Santa Monica, and then I said, we have to scale down, so we bought this little cottage in the Palisades. And
so Palisades was your downsizing.
Yeah. And you know, this was 20 years ago. And so we had this little tiny cottage, and I just fell into I said, I'm going to write prose. And then I was terrified, or at least intimidated by the idea of writing a book. So I thought I was just going to write magazine articles or whatever. And I started writing magazine articles. And then one article I did, the guy who I wrote the profile of said, you should write my book. And it seemed like an interesting thought, and I did, and I sold it, and then now I just finished my 20th book.
That when you left, you wanted to get into prose. And when I think of prose, and maybe that's my own naivete, I think of fiction as opposed to nonfiction. And in looking at your bio, it seems like a good percentage of what you've done is nonfiction.
Oh, I make it up. No, it's... No, it's true, but no, prose is just, prose can be either fiction or nonfiction, and I think that everything I've ever written or published has been nonfiction. I started by writing essays when I was in college, you know, personal essays about things that would happen to me, or kind of silly comic essays, and then I started doing magazine articles.
Where'd you go to college?
I went to undergraduate at the University of Massachusetts. In Amherst. And then I went to graduate school at the University of Michigan.
Wow, very cool. Two great schools. I have a son who's applying to college, and Amherst was on our radar, and he actually got in. That was
good
very
for him.
Exciting.
Yeah, he'll be very happy.
It's not where he's going. He is going to Boston, but very exciting.
All right.
You were involved in some pretty exciting sitcoms back in the day, right?
Yeah, yes.
Tell us a little bit about that, and then, you know, why were you ready to jump off a bridge at the end?
Well, the first one I did was, I was a child, and I did Sanford and Son. And then a little bit later, we did What's Happening, and I did Mork and Mindy, and I'm going to forget a bunch. a show called Angie with Donna Pesco that my partner and I created.
I remember all these, by the way. I was a young immigrant in the States, and all of these TV shows helped me improve my English,
And so you speak beautifully, so
understand.
Obviously these shows
did
a great impact.
You were a great teacher in addition to being a writer. Yeah.
But these shows also helped me kind of understand America, so amazing writing, yeah. And so I've got to ask you, Stanford and Sons, and those first two that you mentioned, those were pretty tough issues at the time, right, to put into mainstream sort of...
Well, we never thought of it that way. I mean, maybe so, but it was always... First of all, you know, Sanford and Son, I was so naive, you know. I had a writing partner, Larry Mintz, and the two of us worked together, and there were two other, Saul Turtletaub and Bernie Ornstein, were our bosses. It was just the four of us. And we wrote every show, or rewrote every show, and Red was this incredible character, but all he wanted was it to be funny. Mm-hmm. And even though there were some issues that would come out, basically based on Red's life, I only did the last season, by the way. The idea was we always saw the show as about a family, mm-hmm. you know. And even though it was a father and a son, they sort of interacted like kind of a bickering husband and wife sometimes. And so we just thought of it as a family.
Right.
And they had a bad business. They were, you know, in the junk business.
Yeah. Still, I find that interesting. I find it a huge, I guess in hindsight, I feel like there was a lot to unpack there. When you were writing, did Red have a lot to do with the writing? I mean, would you write something that you thought he could authentically say, or would he sort of interact with you guys and come up with scripts that he could sort of...
No, he rarely... The only time I ever remember him interacting with us was one time he said, I saw an episode of All in the Family. He was a little competitive with Carol O'Connor in terms of everything, popularity and money too. He wanted to make as much as Carol, or if not more. And so the only time I ever remember him getting involved was he said, there was an episode in which Archie didn't get out of his chair. I want you to write an episode where I don't get out of my chair. I don't feel like getting out of my chair. So that was really all he did. He was he didn't care as long as it was funny. I mean, he was the quintessential comedian. He was, you know, he went back to the Chitlin circuit and really paid his dues in clubs all over the country. And he just wanted the show to be funny. And that was his criteria. And if
he didn't want it to be a social commentary. He wanted it to be funny and entertaining.
Yeah. If it happened to spill over into that, that would be great. But he really didn't care. He just wanted it to be funny.
Back in the day, how did you guys get feedback? Like today, if there's a sitcom, I'm sure the producers get like email. How did you guys ever gauge if people were listening or paying attention or uncomfortable or comfortable or laughing or whatever?
My memory was, well, we always shot it in front of a live audience, so that was the first thing. And there were always letters. You know, we would get mail. Mail was a big deal. If you got
mail,
you know, that meant something. So I don't recall much. And then I seem to have this vague recollection of there were always focus groups. You know, sometimes they would test things. And we never paid much attention to any of that stuff. But I think the only way we got feedback, and there were ratings. You know, the ratings were much different then. There were only, you know, three networks.
Yeah.
And so many, and there really wasn't any other competition.
No. No, and people watched, and then it was over. It wasn't like they streamed it again or shared it.
Right, it was over, and it was every week, and people looked forward to it. And it, you know, the key thing was trying not to get people to – people became devoted to their channels,
mm-hmm.
you know. This is my shows. These are my programs. This is my channel. So to change something from NBC to ABC wasn't always as easy as people thought. You know, they were sort of hooked on their channel.
Yeah. And there was a lineup they'd stick to.
Yeah.
So at the height of your career, how many sitcoms would you be working on in the course of a week? Because weeks whip around pretty fast.
Well, the only time, we would always only work on one show at a time, except when we started out, we were doing Sanford and Son, and at the time, you would do 24 episodes a season. And so we were writing an episode of Sanford and Son, and our bosses came in and said, drop it right away. We just got a show picked up called What's Happening. It's going on the air. You got to put down the show you're writing. And we had just written, I remember typing, there was a knock on the door. Mm-hmm. And our boss, put it down. You got to write this other show called What's Happening. So we wrote What's Happening and Sanford and Son at the same time.
Uh-huh.
So that was crazy. So we wrote, like, I don't remember, 48 episodes in a year. And then I remember we had to go back to that script, and I couldn't remember who was knocking on the door.
No.
We said, who is it outside? It can't be Red. He's inside. So we didn't know. So we had to figure it out.
Was that the episode where he never got out of the chair?
He never got out of his chair.
So I wanted to ask you a question about that. As I recall, and it's been a long time, Sanford and Son had a lot of racial issues involved. Am I right?
Well, again, I only did the last season of it. And by then, I think there were. And I think there was sort of dialogue, language, conversation that I don't think you could ever have on a network show now. But again, the season we did, there really weren't racial issues at all. It was all kind of, fun, sort of family issues, The last episode that we wrote was Red admitted that he never finished high school.
Mm.
And so he went back to get his diploma in night school.
His equivalency.
And actually, I was in that episode. I was one of the students in the class.
Oh, wow.
And Red cheated off me. He leaned over my ear and I said, get away from me. And so.
How interesting.
But so we really didn't write. Our intention was never to become sort of to deal with those issues. We just didn't do it.
Because I noticed, and I can say this because I'm Jewish, that in the writers that you mentioned that you worked with, I think every name I heard sounded like a Jewish name. And so I was just wondering how a bunch of funny Jewish guys would deal with the racial issues without apparently having any other racial minorities.
It's such a good question, and it's one that I'm going to be writing about, I think, or I'm intending to write about in a book. And because the answer is, it was such a different time, and you're 100% right about that fact. I mean, there were that was the time when there were more Jews on the writing staffs of sitcoms than ever before. And it was just, that was what, Red thought that Jewish people were funny. He just thought that, that was the definition. We were connected in that way.
So there was, you were funny, that made you qualified. There was never a sense like, well, should we have an African-American writer on the staff or anything like that?
Well, there was a famous story that I really don't want to say too much about, but that there was pressure from black groups from the NAACP to put, to put an African American on the staff, and Red hated it. He hated the idea, and it wasn't that he just didn't think it was a funny enough script.
I mean, to me, it makes sense back then that, like you say, times change, right? We've evolved to today where we can openly talk about these things, or maybe even in hindsight, we can say that a show like Sanford and Son had a lot to unpack. But it seems like at the time, Red just wanted to be part of the game, right? He wanted to
100%.
Be an actor. Yeah. He wanted to be in there. He wanted to be able to compete with
Carol O'Connor. Well, what you're saying is 100% true.
And he just wanted it to be funny. He didn't want it to be controversial. He didn't want to take a stand. He wanted to get his foot in the game. And I feel like that is the evolution that brings us to today, right? You guys wrote that. You had that show. It became a hit. People were watching it. And so the next level was, okay, maybe a generation later, it was, okay, let's have an African-American on the writing staff. Couldn't have started that way, right? There had to be an evolutionary cycle.
You're 100% right. I couldn't have said it better. The racial stance he made was being there, being in the game, having a show that was literally one of the top-rated shows. It was NBC's number one rated show.
Clearly watched by all, not just...
Absolutely, yeah. Watched by all. He made the decision to end the show himself.
Mm.
He got a quote-unquote better offer.
Mm.
The show was at the height when he quit.
Oh, wow.
He left to go to ABC to do a variety show.
How'd that go?
terrible. It was canceled after nine episodes.
I was
going to
say, none of us remember it.
Yeah. And so being there, making his presence known, competing with, you know, the number one white show, that was the racial statement.
And so you started talking about this and saying how you'd gotten into writing prose because this was pushing you off a cliff. What was it about writing for sitcoms? Was it the day-to-day grind, having to keep churning out work? What was it that was so difficult to keep doing?
Well, for me, it was very simple. When I started out in Sanford and Son and What's Happening, there were really just the four of us, and then we added a few more writers as time went on, and it got to the point where when you did a sitcom, typically you're in a conference room with many other writers. And for me, it got to the point where I literally couldn't hear my own voice. And then that also became symbolic. I couldn't hear my own voice, and I couldn't express my own voice. And what happened was I just couldn't. It became, I respected the form, but I just couldn't, I could no longer write it. I needed to write something in my own voice. I needed to be the one writer on the page. I didn't know if I could do it, by the way. It wasn't like I was making a decision to going from something that I knew I could do to something else that I knew I could do. I had no idea if I could make that transition.
You were taking a leap of faith.
Yeah, I was taking a leap of faith. And again, so did my wife. And we had two kids, and so it was a strange...
Incredible.
Yeah, it was a strange sort of transition. But the answer, Steve, is that I literally couldn't hear my own voice. And I needed to, for better or for worse, get into a different kind of realm.
It's an amazing story because we all know many, many people who probably felt that way, not as writers, but as whatever it may be, teachers, yeah, lawyers, doctors, who said, you know, I got a lifestyle. I don't want to give that up. This is safe. It's secure. I'm going to stay with it. And they stay with it and, you know, they get through it. That's a ballsy move to say you're up at the top of the perch and to say I'm going to jump off and did I land in a soft spot?
Yeah, I mean, again, I'm not sure it was emotional. I'm not sure it was intellectual.
Yeah, I have a writer friend. We were actually roommates in college. She went on to have a career in Hollywood, and then that sort of burned her out, and she decided to be a writer. And so she wrote something just kind of off the top of her head, and it got picked up, and then it became a series, and then she moved to New Orleans and is now teaching writing, right? And I can honestly say this is her third act, but there she was again kind of standing there saying, I think I'm done. I'm going to, you know, try something new, and it worked. And one of the last things she said to me in the last few months was, sometimes you just got to jump and believe that the net will appear.
Yeah.
And
well,
I thought that
great.
Was, yeah, visually.
I will steal that. Cause you didn't tell me your name, so I'll say it was me.
Right. I'll tell your name. yeah, but I thought visually that was exactly what Steve is saying. So many people do this, right? You just kind of take that step and you're like, God, I hope it works out. And there comes the net. So I'm glad it worked out for you.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, I don't think I had a choice, you know. And again, it wasn't. It was just something that I just needed to do. I had to do it. And I didn't see it. I saw it as totally a survival mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like you went from something where you're in boardrooms talking with dozens of people to sitting in an office at home by yourself.
I mean,
the exact
it
opposite.
Was.
What was your first book? You mentioned it. So what was
the first book I wrote
on?
Was with an NFL official. His name was Chad Brown. The book is called Inside the Meat Grinder.
Uh-huh.
And I like telling the story because, I don't know, I just sort of think it's an interesting story. But I had, when we were living in Santa Monica, my son was, he was probably 7 or 8 years old, and he was playing Little League baseball. And for some reason, I don't know if I volunteered or they volunteered me, but I got the thankless job of being the umpire, which is the worst job you can possibly have in Little League baseball. So
right.
Here I am, and it's this championship game, and my son is up with, you know, kids on base, and they're two outs. And the kid who's pitching, he's like throwing 100 miles an hour. I can't believe he throws a strike down the middle of the plate, and my son doesn't swing, and I have to call him out.
Aww.
So I called my son out on strikes.
Aww.
And one of the parents on the team was married to Deborah Winger, the actress, and she came running over to me and she said, if you write that story, I'll read it for NPR.
Oh, wow.
And I said, huh, write that story. Wow.
About calling your
about
son
calling
out.
Your own son out on strikes in a little league game. So it took me a year to come up with either the courage or the, I don't know, wherewithal to do it. And this was in the transition of, and one of the first things I wrote, maybe the first thing, was the essay about how I called my son out on strikes. And so I ended up I didn't want to say anything about my career, so I just sent it out blindly to some magazines. I sent it out to a magazine called Referee Magazine.
Oh, wow.
Which is, it turns out to be sort of the trade journal for all the officials in all sport. And so I sent it out to them. And they called me up and said, we want to buy it for $100. And I said, this is the most exciting thing in my life. And I called a really close friend of mine who's a writer, and I said, I just sold my first article to Referee Magazine. He said, what is Referee Magazine? What the hell is that? I said, I don't know. He said, call up the LA Times. They have a magazine. Just call them up and tell them you have this article. I said, they're never going to listen to me. And he said, just call them up. So I called up, and Alice Short, who was the editor of the LA Times magazine at the time, said, yes, it's Alice Short. And I said, well, I got this article. And she said, send it to me. So I sent it to her. She called me back in 5 minutes and said, we're going to print this. I sold it to Referee Magazine and to the LA Times. And the reason I'm telling you this is that after I sold it to Referee Magazine, they offered me sort of profiles.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the profiles they offered me was a guy named Chad Brown, who was the first black umpire ever to officiate a Super Bowl. So I wrote this piece about him, and that led to my first book.
I see.
Working with Alice, I did another piece. I used to have a basketball game at my house in Santa Monica. I had all these guys who would come to my house. So I wrote a piece for the LA Times about that, and that led to another book called 10 on Sunday, which was about the game I had at my house. So these magazine articles, all stemming from the one little article about my son striking out.
Yeah, that were the start of this.
You just hit
career.
A chord with me, because for many, many years, probably 15 years, 20 years, I don't know, I played in a Saturday morning basketball game. We used to play at Lincoln Middle School in Santa Monica outside on the pavement. And it was the same guys. And, you know, we all had connections through work. And we talk about our work. We talk about our lives, our families. And it was like a tale of our lives for that time period. And then, I don't know about yours, but ours slowly ended as guys started getting injured, back injuries, knees, and the guy'd be out for 6 months, then a year, then we had trouble making a game, and then after a while it just petered out. But it was a magical time, and I used to love Saturday mornings for that reason.
Yeah, it was absolutely magical, and we played for 5 years, and we played up until the point where I sold the house.
Yeah.
Which was a very emotional moment. And we played in my – and to be honest with you, many of the guys still play. They play at some other venue someplace. And so I can't believe they're still playing. I mean, you know – and I actually got injured playing in the game too.
So but you all could have been in that same basketball league together.
Yeah.
We could have.
It was so stupid though, because I hurt myself – I hurt my shoulder – but they didn't stop coming. These guys they kept coming to my house while I couldn't play. And I said, anybody need a bagel? It was like, you know, it was crazy. So for a year, you know, they kept playing while I just sat there and
you could have ref.
Yeah, but you got to participate in the schmoozing, which was just as important.
There was plenty of schmoozing.
Yeah.
So what I do find amazing about these times that you describe is your ability to just call the New York Times, get the editorial desk, you know,
It's nuts. I don't know how. I don't know why.
Yeah, get the editor to call you back in 5 minutes and say, we'll take it. That is truly surreal if you compare it to what might happen today.
It's completely surreal.
But let me ask you, when you call those places, did you send them something in advance?
No.
I'm Alan Eisenstock.
No.
I wrote for Mork and Mindy. I wrote for Sanford and Son.
No.
I've written this article. You just, a guy out of the blue calling up and they took your calls.
Yeah,
and
I know. It seems crazy, but that's what it was.
Yeah.
No. It was.
That's why I think it's surreal.
It was totally surreal.
It's like a cold
you know, the
call
chances of, the chances of her actually answering the phone
Are
you know,
pretty slim.
Were probably slim. And
yeah.
So,
so I see
I
this
know.
Theme in your writing. Tell me if it's there or if I'm just seeing it. You do these... you kind of dig in and give people the backstory, like the inside story of something that maybe we're all curious about. You seem to find these key people who can take you, you know, over to the back room and show you about this, you know, these like, you know, life events or issues that we're all wondering about, and you give us this insight. Is that does it just come to you? Do you look for it? Are you comfortable writing it that way?
Well, you know, lately, too, this is interesting because we talked initially or a while ago about the whole idea of, well, the concept of race, social justice as being part of Sanford and Son. And I would argue that at least in my experience, it was really more about the comedy. Well, lately, I have been writing books that have dealt with social justice. And, you know, the book I have coming out that I wrote with this wonderful attorney, wonderful story, a guy named Jared Adams is coming out in September 14th. It's called Redeeming Justice, and it's about his experience becoming a lawyer. He was incarcerated. Quick story is that when he was 17 years old, he and a couple of friends went to a party. He's black. He went to a party, and they were the only black people on the campus of this university in Wisconsin. He had consensual sex with a white girl. And 6 weeks later, she said that they all raped her, and he was convicted of rape and got 28 years in federal prison. And while he was in prison, he got found himself helping other prisoners. He hung out at the law library and cut to, as they say, he, with the help of the Wisconsin Innocence Project, he got out after 10 years, totally exonerated. And then he went to law school, became a lawyer, and now he's helping people who are like him, were like
Incredible.
Him.
Incredible.
And so...
So he's helping other...
Other people who have either been wrongly accused... Or wrongly convicted or are serving horribly excessive sentences for minor crimes. And so how I fell into it was, I don't know, I just... Thankfully, I'm at the point now where I can hear... somebody's story connect to their character, which is the same thing really to me, and feel that I have to write the book. And, you know, hopefully everything will align, the stars will align, the subject or the whatever you want to call connects to me, I connect to that person, and then the result will hopefully be a book that will...
And are you now in a position where you get advances before you write books?
Yes.
Because you've got enough body of work that they're going to say, he'll write another winner.
Well, and I have a good agent.
I was going to say, you must readily have a publisher.
Yeah. Well, I have a really good agent, and he's able to, you know, find the right homes for these particular projects. And
Redeeming Justice sounds like a great book. I'm dying to read it. But before that, you have Bulletproof.
Yeah.
And then you have this Love Thy Neighbor, A Muslim Doctor's Struggle for Home in Rural America. How'd you stumble upon that? And
that was a front page article of the Washington Post. And that was the story of Ayaz Birji, who was a doctor who we had sort of a similar connection in that he had been working in a city and really felt that the rural America, he felt it and he knew it, was being really underserved by, you know, doctors. And so he decided he wanted to move to a really small town.
Wow.
And he moved to a tiny town, Dawson, Minnesota, population of, I want to say, like under 2,000 people.
Wow.
And so he became the doctor in this town. He's Muslim, and he and his family went there. They were the only Muslims in the town. And everything seemed to be okay. And then Trump got elected, and he felt and saw a big change, and he felt things kind of turning on him. And he, so there was a big article, and he started to give talks about, there were lots of misconceptions about Islam and his beliefs. And so he was very reluctant. He didn't really want to, he's a practicing Muslim, but he didn't see himself as somebody who wanted to necessarily
preach.
And so he was convinced by a Christian pastor at one of the churches to give a talk mm-hmm. about his religion. And so he did, and then it started to snowball, and other towns asked him to do this. And he called the talks Love Thy Neighbor.
Ah.
So that's the title of the book. So the book is about him, his move to this town, what happened to him, and how he started giving these talks.
And they were well received?
Yes. Sometimes. And sometimes,
yeah, I would think that sometimes they would also generate some backlash.
Yes. And he would go to certain other little towns, and he got, people were just, they called him all sorts of names, and he feared for his life at one point. And so that was the, and that was based on, like I say, on the Washington Post article. It was the front page of the Washington Post.
They all look really interesting, but this is the last one I'm going to have you tell us about. Playing God, the Evolution of a Modern Surgeon.
Yeah, I am. So that's a sequel to a book called In Stitches. So there's a doctor, Dr. Tony Yoon, Anthony Yoon, we've become really good friends. And Tony is a plastic surgeon, and he now calls himself a holistic plastic surgeon because he looks at ways to try to deal with people, you know, changing, you know, whatever plastic surgery entails mm-hmm. in all aspects. So we got together, and he wanted to tell his story, which was really about going through medical school. And he's Asian, and he has a really sort of interesting relationship with his father, and how he dealt with his father, and how he got through medical school. And Playing God is the sequel to that, which is becoming a doctor, and how he went through his residency and his internship and everything, and how he ultimately, even though he did a fellowship here in Beverly Hills, he ultimately decided to open his practice in sort of a suburb of Detroit.
Mm.
And so it's kind of not what people think about plastic surgery being, you know, like, you know, they make a fortune
frivolous.
And all of it. It was really hard when he decided to go out on his own to open his own practice. And so that's the story of it. And it's fun. They're both books are really funny, and he's a wonderful guy. And so that's that story.
Well, I can't wait to read Redeeming Justice, and if your punch hunt for funny makes it into these really difficult stories about social justice, then I think it just makes it easier to read. So
I have to ask you, there's so many of these books that sound great to me that I wish I could read them all right now, but one that caught my eye is Hang Time.
Yeah.
Because, as you know, I played on my high school basketball team, and that's when my career ended, but Elgin Baylor, for those of us old enough to have seen him play, he had this mystique about him, and people, the way he played, I can't describe it, but people actually felt that he could hang in the air longer than gravity would allow most people to force people to hit the ground. I mean, he just went up, it was like he'd go up for a layup or something, and you have the feeling like he was stepping on a stepladder. He'd go a little bit higher and never seemed to come down. So as a young guy, he was one of my heroes, and amazing player.
It was an honor to write Elgin's book with him. And was the first thing I'll say about him is that there are a few people who literally changed the game of basketball. Elgin Baylor changed the game of basketball. Before he played, the game was horizontal. It was basically a bunch of white guys passing, you know, the ball, shooting set shots. Elgin elevated the game. He made the game vertical. He changed the game from being a horizontal game to a vertical game. And he did things that no one had ever seen before. And other players admitted that they copied him or tried to copy him. Kobe Bryant admitted it. Dr. J admitted it. Because nobody, as you say, Steve, nobody had ever seen anybody do what he did. He didn't invent the jump shot, but he perfected it. And he said that I couldn't shoot with two hands like this. And so he shot it over his head. And altogether, I spent 4 years working on the book. And Elgin and I would get together two or three times a week at least, and we would hang out at his house, and we would just, he was reluctant at first. His wife, Elaine, who's just this marvelous, wonderful person, she convinced him that he had to tell his story. Because what happened here, as you know, when he became the general manager of the Clippers for 20-some-odd years...
Under Donald Sterling.
Those years, not only diminished him as a person, but they obliterated him as a player. So people didn't associate him, especially younger people, with his who he was as a basketball player, and as, in his own quiet way, kind of a real supporter of human rights and racial equality when it came to basketball. I mean, he did a lot in terms of that.
Yeah.
And as I say, I wrote, you know, we got together all this time, and we traveled. We went to Seattle. He played for Seattle University, and we went there. He's from Washington, D.C., so we went to Washington, and I saw where he grew up and where he played. They opened the gym. The high school that he played at was closed, but the city opened it up for us, and they showed him. It was amazing. The high school looked like it had been bombed, except for the gym. The gym, for some reason, seemed preserved, and Elgin just walked.
Wow.
We walked down, up and down the gym, and he just... You know, he was in his 80s then, and he just...
Well, because I got to see him play, I still think of Elgin the basketball player. But I know, and you mentioned it, I know he played, he was the GM under Sterling, and Sterling, you know, there's been plenty written about Sterling, not the nicest guy in the world, to say
right.
the least.
Right.
And ruined many careers, and he ended up losing out in the end anyway. But Elgin was just always a prince of a guy and such a great athlete.
He was just a wonderful, wonderful guy. And we got along great. And the first thing I said to him, I said, listen, this is going to be a little tough because I'm from New England. You know, I'm Boston. I'm a Celtics fan. And so he said, well, we're going to have a hard time. And so, but we didn't. We had a great time. He was friends with Bill Russell. And Elgin never won a championship at any level.
I didn't remember that.
And he lost to the... I believe they lost to the Celtics 7 times.
Ouch.
And it was always, he said, it was always because of Russell. It's the one thing they just couldn't match up.
Yeah, nobody could.
Yeah, nobody could. And I love the book. And again, it was just an honor to do the book with him.
I can't wait to read it.
You've met some really cool people.
I have, and I'm so grateful for that.
And how did I know we're about done, but how did these topics... subjects come to you? Is it just somebody will call you and say, I got an idea, or you think about, oh, there's a guy I'd like to write a story about,
or you meet people that seem
yeah
really cool.
I think it's kind of all three, but I have to again give my agent a lot of credit because we work so well together. He kind of knows me and knows the stuff that will interest me, so he'll call and say, here's one for you. I think this is something that I think you could write. I wrote a book with Captain Ron Johnson, 13 Days in Ferguson, which had to do with the unrest in Ferguson, Missouri. And that one really, my agent said, I think you got to write this book. And I was intrigued by, here was this police officer, highway patrol captain, who was put in charge of the unrest in Ferguson, and how he was able to walk the line. On the one hand, he's black and was part of that community. On the other hand, he was blue. He was a police officer, and how he was able to have to walk down the middle of those of the road. And so the answer to that question is, my agent said, and once I, he told me about him, and once I talked to Ron, who's become a good friend too, I just knew I had to do this book. I had to tell the story.
Seems like you follow your instinct and it works. So to the extent that this is the Palisades podcast, and we're all Palisadian, what do you think is the big issue? I mean, tell us about your Palisadian life, and then, you know, what do you think is the big issue that faces the Palisades these days?
Boy, I don't know. I haven't really thought about that. As
he never
I say,
leaves
we
his
have
house.
No issues.
I don't leave my house, you know, and so I mean...
Internet service might be a big one right. for you.
Well, I know that there's been a lot of issues with you know, the homeless encampments, which I guess has...
It's now over.
Now over. You know, I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure what the big issue of the Palisades is, because I sort of see myself more as a citizen of the world than a citizen of the Palisades.
But you're staying in the Palisades.
As far as I know, unless somebody calls me up and says, you got to leave, I think I'm going to stay there. I've seen incredible change.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. I mean, I don't want to be one of these people who says... You know, it used to be better in the old days.
Right.
I don't know, you know. And, I mean, yeah, there were things that I really do miss about the quote-unquote old Palisades Village. But I don't think we need to – I have a hard time, you know. Sometimes I wonder if the biggest issue we have is just, is it a place that's becoming too, I don't know what the word I'm searching for, too special?
Well, we certainly try privileged. To keep it that way. I think
too
that's
privileged.
True.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, and also we sort of, I feel like there's a concerted effort in the Palisades to keep it sort of authentic and Palisadian,
yeah.
not stray too far from, you know, what you say, the good old days. But yeah, the reality is time marches on, and it's always easy to look back and say, oh, it was perfect then, but probably wasn't.
I don't think it was perfect then, and I don't think it's perfect now, but I think that's sort of the way it is.
Yeah.
I'll just say the last thing, the reason about, we ended up in the Palisades because my wife and I, when we decided that I was going to make this change, we dealt with a lot of issues. One issue being, should we stay here?
Mm-hmm.
If I'm going to not work in television and do this, you know, maybe we should move back to New England. And maybe we should find a small town where our kids can walk to school, walk to the village. Well, we found it, and it was the Palisades.
And not in New England. I love it. Yep. That's true. That is very true about the Palisades, and it's a big part of the appeal.
You don't have to deal with snow out here, at least not very often.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I can honestly say it was truly a pleasure to have you on. You know, we do tend to talk to some very interesting people. The Palisades seems to be full of them. And usually at the end of a conversation, we've gotten to know somebody better, and it's always pleasant. But you know, with you, it's kind of been a meandering through history. And, you know, through you, we've gotten to know a few other really interesting people. And you really have I hope you write your own life story one of these days, because it's quite an interesting one. Thank you for sharing your time with us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, and I look forward to going home and buying some new books.
Step right up.
Yeah, and you got to put us, at least for me, put me on your email list.
Oh, yeah. Yep. So everybody check out September 14th, new book coming out by Alan Eisenstock, and get his playlist to get yourselves through COVID times. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in.
Thanks, Alan.
Thank you.